Hi, good morning. I'm sort of taking the chair's privilege of the conference privilege to tell you a little bit about our resource today, about the National Resource for Automated Molecular Microscopy. The resource is supported by the National Center for Research Resources. That's who provides all the money. And there's several other resources strongly represented here. WAS Resource has several people, and WAS will tell you more about their activities. You already heard from Andy Honger about what they do in Boulder. That's also an NCRR-supported resource. And Joachim, who doesn't run the resource anymore, but did for many years in Albany. And there's a couple of others, too. So the overall mission of NRAM is to develop, test, and apply technology aimed towards automating and streamlining electron microscopy for structural biology. And like all NCRR resources, we have five aims. We have to develop new core technology to be used in the community, and it has to be new. Can't just buy it off the shelf. We work with collaborators to drive and test that technology. We provide service, more straightforward, and then we do training, hence this workshop, and we do dissemination. And I'll tell you mostly about the core technology research and development we do, and then just mention at the end a little bit about the other activities. So at NRAM, you know, the EM pipeline consists, like most EM pipelines, you know, of specimen preparation, data collection, processing, and then analysis. We are not experts at this sample preparation, and I completely agree with what many of the speakers have said, that is where, you know, the most work needs to be done. That is it's such a difficult step, and without good protein, you're nowhere. And I think, you know, that is really the hardest step. These other steps can be automated that possibly can't be. And then the interpretation also is very difficult, and WAS Resource does a lot of work on that. That's not really our expertise. So just a couple of words about specimen preparation. Nigel mentioned yesterday, and I quite agree, it's possibly the most critical step. I mean, for a long time, we had an enormous amount of difficulty. We have like 100 projects or so a year at NRAM, and we have to be able to get that specimen on the grid into the scope as rapidly as possible. A solution for us has certainly been this Gatan plasma cleaner and the FEI Vitrobot. The two devices together seem to provide us with a level of functionality that, you know, most researchers, after, you know, a few hours having arrived at the resource, can get their grid into the scope. One thing we did develop, though, was these new C-flat grids, and that was because for very small particles, we found that there'd be a thick lip of ice near the edge of the hole, and all the small particles would end up crowded and swept into that area, and we couldn't do anything with them. So Joel Quisp, in collaboration with Protochips, developed this new kind of grid, which is now sold commercially as C-flat, and that was an activity of the resource, really driven by our need to get very large numbers of particles and our total frustration that if they all end up in this tiny area of the grid, you know, your throughput's not very high. So this was a real need driven by throughput requirements. You already heard yesterday about these new cryomesh grids. That was really driven, again, by the need to... We believe very strongly in getting tilted pairs of everything. And in getting tilted pairs in ice charging was a total nightmare for us. You know, it was a real bottleneck. I think anybody who's done much of it knows that you're sometimes throwing 80% of your images away. This seems to be a solution, these cryomesh grids. And as you heard from Craig yesterday, it's possible that these grids also might help with high-resolution data. I mean, if they are very rigid and stable and conductive, then it may improve getting high-resolution 2D crystallography data at high tilts. You know, maybe it can be a solution for that. What are we going to do next at the resource? We're just going to start using them. We've already, you know, done several reconstructions on this cryomesh grid. You know, not very high resolution or anything. This was just a quick test run. I'm going to start using them for, I said, routine data collection. You know, only things, obviously, that need very high resolution or where we're trying to push the resolution. We're also going to continue testing them. We have TMV data now we've collected on these grids, and we'll do the sorts of things that Richard and Bob did, you know, some time ago to try and evaluate whether we really are getting an improvement in the high-resolution data from these grids. Okay. I really think there's so much more to be done with specimen preparation, though. I mean, Joachim's resource proposed some really cool things to do with microfabrication. You know, you could microfab a grid, and you could use it sort of to do self-blotting and you know, level the ice out into exactly the right thickness. And I think there's a lot more work to be done in that area. It's still incredibly frustrating, you know, to use this big macroscopic piece of blotting paper, you know, to try and make a 1,000 angstrom thick layer of ice. I mean, surely there must be ways to do that. And we certainly will work on that, and I'm guessing some of the other resources will continue to work on that too. So the next step, once you have your specimen, is automated data collection. You've heard a lot about Legionon. For anybody who doesn't know much about it, it's basically a multi-scale automated data acquisition. We acquire a grid atlas. Usually the user selects the squares because they're better at it, and it only takes a little while. Once you have those squares, the rest is automated. You take a picture of the square, find all the holes, find all the holes with the right ice thickness that you've dialed in. Once you have a hole, take the next mag up, you know, select a focus point, select a bunch of points to take high mag images, do the focusing, check for drift, blah, 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 and you land up with your high mag images. And this can just then go on for days and days and days. And you sit in the control room admiring every shiny image that comes in. Not really. I mean, we really do think you have to have a high level of automation for these kinds of projects. We recently did an experiment with Jim Hogle's group, and they wanted to look at poliovirus. But there's a large number of intermediates. The sample is very messy. It's full of, you know, RNA. It's tangled up. It's kind of an ugly sample. So the only way to get the numbers of images you need, because you have to go and sort these intermediates, and they're not very nice, is to collect a huge number of images. So we spent about a week, collected 15,000 images from about, which we got about 500,000 particles, which is disappointing. We really wanted 1,000,000 particles. So what would have improved that throughput? A Titan Krios. That would have been very helpful because we were switching grids all the time. We were wasting a whole day every now and again trying to find a perfect grid, contaminating the scope, having drift, things like that. What would enormously improve it too is a CMOS camera. Because if we had a CMOS camera, we could take images at lower magnification, we get much more real estate, our throughput goes up. And then what also would have improved it is the ribosome, because there are many more of those per image than there are poliovirus. So if only we had collected that, we'd be much better off. So Legionon can collect these straightforward high mag images. It also has modules to straightforwardly, as much as can be done straightforwardly, collect tilt pairs. We really do believe in tilt pairs, and I think we've heard so much at this workshop saying how valuable those tilt pairs are. So we, you know, initially started doing it just to get initial models. But of course, when you have heterogeneity, they're invaluable, as several people pointed out, and Holger demonstrated very beautifully. And then Richard's criteria, you know, for judging the validity of a map really requires tilt pairs. So the goal, really, with Legionon is that once that grid's in the scope, you should be able to collect a whole variety of data. You should be able to collect your zero-degree pairs. You can collect your zero-degree images, your tilted pairs, maybe at small angles, maybe at large angles, and you can collect tomograms. And then you could have all of this data to build your initial models to validate your data. So the Legionon is set up so that you have the choice of collecting all of that data or mixing and matching to get, you know, a variety of types of data. So what's next for Legionon is to do automated alignments. You heard Angie talking about this earlier. I think we, you know, limit our resolution to a large extent because our microscope is not as perfectly aligned as it could be. I mean, you're basically dependent on whoever aligned it, and I think we could do so much better. We hope with these kinds of methods we can A, do better, and B, judge how well we did, you know, so that there's some feedback to the user to show you, no, it's not good enough yet. Maybe then the user has to tweak a bit, but at least there's some real direct feedback saying, you know, you have this coma and you're not going to do very well. You know, I think when you have images like that, it should be directly connected to a resolution map showing a big red line that says you're not going to get past this if you leave it like that. You know, sometimes I think these difficulties with the data are not connected up enough to, you know, what the consequences are. And you're impatient, you want to get started. But if you're going for high resolution, there's no point in starting until that microscope is in exactly the state you want. And then we are going to try and add more intelligence into the system. I mean, Legionon is certainly not easy to use. Like all automation that tries to do what a human being does, human beings are brilliant at vision. And, you know, people get incredibly impatient when the computer is not as good as them and, you know, gets mixed up and misaligns things. So we do need to try and build more intelligence into the system, try and have it a little bit more fail-safe. When it's working great, it works all the time. But if it gets into a mess, as I think was obvious the other day, we're trying to collect a tomogram. Although that turned out, the reason the tomogram couldn't be collected on the direct electron is because the noise is so low, there's zeros in the dark field. So we were dividing by zero. We've never had that problem before. So we can fix that one. Okay, so once you've got your data, you want to process it. And, you know, as with all processing, there's a number of steps. Particle picking, got to get the contrast transfer function, correct for it. Extract your particles into stacks, alignment, classification. You may need to create an initial model, do a reconstruction, and analyze your density. And there's lots and lots of EM processing tools out there. One of the problems is there's so many EM processing tools out there, it can be a bit overwhelming. I know from reading the literature, most people are mixing and matching a whole variety of tools. I mean, people are, you know, starting Animagic, going to FreeAlign, back into EMAN, you know, trying some Spider. I mean, it's a big mixture. And none of these packages have ever reached a consensus on what an Euler, you know, which Euler angles are, you know, what, which directions the symmetry axis is. You know, they all have different underlying assumptions. And if you're going to mix and match, you have to be terribly careful that you don't get things mixed up. So, and then the next problem is, of course, most of them start by saying enter file name. And if you did this 3 months ago, it's like, oh, you know, what did I do, call that data? Where did I put it? Which directory is it in? You can have complete chaos. So this is the reason we developed this pipeline, which we call Appion, for want of a better name. And the idea with it is to keep track of the data and sort of, you know, put a framework around some of these packages, make them easier to use. So most people are familiar with the LegendOn web interface. Once you have data coming in, you can page through it. And then you, as soon as you have data, and you can upload this data into the database, if you don't use LegendOn, by the way, then you can go to the processing pages. And the processing pages give you a whole bunch of options. You can select particles, you can do CTF estimation, make stacks, etc., etc. And all of these are a whole bunch of different programs underlying them, but they all have a similar user interface. For instance, Alan Roseman's FindEM template correlator, which we use all the time. If you click on template picking, this is the little page that pops up for you. And then all of the inputs are either defaulted, and then you can get a little bit of advice, a little bit of documentation about them. You can test the settings of these, the various settings you have on a test image and see directly the results. And then once you're ready to go, you can either just show the Python command that would be generated to run this, and then you have that command. You can edit it if you like. You can change it. You can run it a million times. Or is more likely in our resource, just run it. And it submits it to a cluster, starts running, tells you it's running, and then you can track it from there. You can go click on that button. It'll tell you how far it's got, how many particles were picked, you know, what it's doing, etc. As soon as that's happening, too, of course, you get all that data reported back onto the images. So you can go and look at your picked particles and browse through them. Similarly, there's buttons here to look at your contrast transfer function to, you know, watch exactly what's going on with this process. So one of the ideas with Appion is to try and bring the data to people in a much more transparent way. I think people are less inclined to look at their results if they're struggling to find them. They've got to figure out which directory they're in. They've got to find some program to use to look at the data. If it's all just there, it's a little bit more transparent. So there's a whole bunch of different options for all of these things. Template picking is Alan Roseman's template picking. Dog picking was written at our facility by Craig Yoshioka. There's manual picking, which was written by Neil Voss. Neil made these slides. That's why his name's not on them. Sorry, Neil. And if you've collected tilt pairs, the software, you know, detects that and then offers you also to align and edit tilt pairs, either manually or automatically. So all of these options become available within LegendOn, within Appion. So one of the things we've been working on most recently is to develop initial models. I mean, it's the biggest bottleneck at our resource. If somebody comes here with an icosahedral virus, great, no problem. You know, we know we can get them to a sub-nanometer map within a few days. But you come with some unknown blob, you know, how do you even get started? So for the last year, we spent a lot of effort thinking about initial models, and we have a variety of options. Of course, you could just upload one from PDB. You could upload one from EMDB, and there's a little, you know, web page that, you know, says what resolution you'd like it reduced to, etc., etc. And you type in the EMDB, and it's uploaded and ready to go in the database. More likely, though, you don't have models there, and you're going to use one of these de novo techniques, either RCT volume generation, common lines, or maybe tomography. So that's all available in the pipeline. These applications, RCT and common lines, all need alignment and classification to start. So a lot of the pipeline is devoted to this alignment and classification methods, and Appian offers a variety of those, XMIP, maximum likelihood, SPIDER, reference-based, IMAGIC, multi-reference, a sort of combination of things that Rinoli, thank you, wrote at Scripps, and then various others. So those are all options for alignment, and then there's options for feature analysis, again, multiple of them. And the good thing is you can mix and match them. So you can start with XMIP maximum likelihood alignment and then do SPIDER correspondence analysis. Or you could do SPIDER reference-based alignment and then do correspondence analysis. So you can mix these together, and the database is taking care of all the interpretation between them. And then you can look at these results and decide which ones you like and explore them. We have no idea what is the best strategy yet, and I suspect, like with all things, it's specimen dependent. So you should try a bunch of things out before deciding on which is the best one. Once you have a set of classes, you can do a bunch of things with them. Steve Latke showed this also very beautifully in EMAN 2. And obviously, once you have your classes, you may want to view the raw particles. A really, really good idea. And again, you know, nice if you can just click on a button and see them. If you have to go do something, people are inclined not to go and look at them. You can create substacks from those classes and say, okay, I can see this as noise, so I know now how to filter my data. You can create templates, because now you may want to go and pick all your particles again. You can create an RCT volume, because it's already known, if you've done the tilt pair picking, what the relative angles are, and the classification gets the rest of the data. So you're all ready to go as soon as you're at this step. And then you can do various common lines. So, and here's an example. The web pages look just the same as usual. Here's the input page for random conical tilt. You know, basically there's not much to say. You've already done all the work. You say create the volume, and then it gives you all the data back in this sort of web-based form again, and you can look at it. So the idea with all this is to try and make it as straightforward as possible to try as many different methods of getting an initial model as possible. We want to, you know, maybe use some things from the databases and see if those work. We want to do angular reconstitution. We try random conical tilt, and we try tomography, and then refine using those initial models and see whether we get a consensus. Consensus doesn't tell you you're right, but when this initial model is good, the final result, they always look the same. When the initial model is bad, the final results can be a whole bunch of different ugly-looking structures, and there's no consensus reached. So maybe this helps you again a little bit in deciding when you have a correct initial model. And the idea is to put it all together and make it as easy and straightforward as possible to use. Okay, so once you have your initial model, you want to do a reconstruction. The reconstruction gives you lots of data back. You know, every iteration is giving you the FSC curve. You can look at the classes. You can look at the good particles, the bad particles. You can do all kinds of things. Once you have a map you like, you can choose it as an exemplar. Say this is the one you think you're going to publish. And once you've chosen that exemplar, you can go and look at every single thing about that map. You know, gobs and gobs of details, the stack it came from, the FSC curve, et cetera, et cetera. Appian also knows exactly how that data was processed, so it can write you your method section for your paper. And this is more than just, it's useful because, you know, why do you want to go and figure out how many particles there were? The database already knows it. It's also particularly important because it provides the citations. I know there is some concern that, you know, Appian is just like this thing gobbling up all these packages, and will packages be cited if they're used within Appian? And at least one, you know, way we're trying to address that is that we generate the citations for the methods paper so they can't be forgotten and left out. Still, it's still a concern, and we're open to any other suggestions for how we can address that and, you know, increase people's level of comfort with having their packages part of Appian. Okay, so what we're going to do next is continue adding new software. Jose Maria Carazzo's group visited and spent 3 weeks here a month or so ago. And they added all that lovely XMIP CurdEnSOM. You know, it's quite hard to use within XMIP. And now it's really very nice to use inside Appian, and it seems to be, you know, lots of people's favorite method of alignment and classification. And Nico was kind enough to agree to stay on for a few extra days and help us get FreeAlign really well integrated into the pipeline. It's sort of there, but we're not experts, and we don't quite know how we should be using it. And more than that, what data we should be getting back, because FreeAlign gives you enormous amounts of metadata after running, and we need to know how to present that and how to show that to the user in the most useful way. So we do continue adding software, and actually just this week, Neil Voss added this method. Richard was describing this EMB factor, where there's a piece of software available out there, so Neil went and pulled that piece of software in, and now you can sharpen your maps using that method within Appian, and here's an example of a sharpening on that poliovirus structure that we've been working on. And it's, you know, at about 5 to 7 angstroms. And again, you know, we'd be very careful to cite that B sharpening if it is used to generate a map in this way. So what the other thing that we're doing more with Appian is to continue developing new methods. Dimitri Lumpus in our group is very interested in trying various variations of angular reconstitution. You know, one of the things with angular reconstitution, at least the way it's done in eMagic, is you choose those first three class averages. So what Dimitri has done instead is sort of automate that, and he has the class averages, the first one randomly selected, and then goes after the most different ones based on various criteria, and then generates a whole number of 3D models, you know, where n specified by the user. It could be 100 or 200 or 300. And then once you have all those 3D models, you can do 3D clustering using a method called affinity propagation. The good thing about this method is, A, it's very fast for 3D alignments, and B, it doesn't have you choose how many classes you're going to get. It basically decides how many classes based on the data that it's presented with, and the sort of idea that there are exemplars within this data set, and those exemplars eventually converge into centers, and those are the number of initial models you have. And I think that's quite important, because we don't really know how many we have, and, you know, by saying we want 20 or 30 or 50, we're biasing the data, and maybe this will help a little bit with that. So once you have those 3D models, you can choose one, and you can then, you know, run it through the pipeline and refine it and see what you've got. And you could do this many, many, many times and see if you get a consensus. Okay, so that's the core technology developments we're doing. We'll you know, continue to do this, but at all times these are driven by collaborative projects. That's the design of NCRR, and I must say I think it's an excellent design. I think technology developed in the absence of real, honest drivers is kind of useless, because you end up just, you know, developing it for yourself. So it's always driven by good collaborative projects. We did a lot of work when Gabe Lander was a grad student in the lab, working with Jack Johnson, and he solved a really large number of structures in lots of different ways, and taking it apart in various different ways. You already heard about our project that Anka Mulder is heading up with Jamie Williamson to do the sort of analysis of the 30S ribosome subunit assembly. And then we, too, are working on the risk learning complex, and Pikwe Lau, together with Ian McCrae, has been working on that structure. And then we're also starting a new project with Ray Stevenson that Arnie Muller will be the postdoc on. You can see the theme here. These are very heterogeneous. These are heterogeneous and small, and these are membrane proteins. So hence the design of this workshop. These are the three things we're terribly interested in at the moment and find enormously challenging. So, I mean, this workshop has been incredibly useful for us, and we really thank all the speakers for providing so much advice. Then we do a lot of service work. Legionon, when was this? It was about a few months ago. Collected its millionth image. It happened to be Justin Coleman at 12:33 a.m. in the morning. So Dave's group has been coming down to use the facility quite a lot while their microscope has been down. And we have basically, you know, one large service or collaborative visitor a month, or at least we try to keep it to about that. So people who want to use the resource, there's a website you can apply online. We can allocate you time. And I think several people in this audience have used that, Kathy Lawson, Dan Southworth, and a bunch of others. Okay, so I said we had these five missions, they're core technology development, collaborative service, and of course training is one of them, and that's why we hold these workshops, which have been steadily getting bigger. So this is this year's, and then we hold also mini workshops for Legionon and for Appian. We had a Legionon training workshop last week, and we'll start having Appian training workshops once Appian is officially released. So what we do for dissemination, apart from published papers, of course, is distribute these two large packages, Legionon and Appian. They're difficult to distribute because they are complicated, and I know some people have struggled to do that. So what we're going to do next in that is try and make them much easier to use, make it easier to add new features, and we're going to develop a so-called portal. That means if people want to upload their data to our site, we'll have a cluster available where they can do the processing here, and that means they don't have to bother with all this big installation, et cetera. So people who really just want their structure can just use that instead, and we'll book that out the same way as we do the microscopes. How we're going to make this happen is that we were very lucky to get some Recovery Act money from NIH to hire two professional-level software programmers. So their mission for the next 2 years is to try and make this easier to do. It's very hard to do that in a research environment, you know, to make something professional-level distribution when you've basically got two programmers working on everything. So that's what we'll do there. So this is the group. We have professional-level programmers. Jim is sort of basically built Appian and now has just been joined by Amber Harold and Eric Howe, our Recovery Act funded people. Joel, a lot of you know, is a great EM expert, and he developed the C-flats and a bunch of other really innovative technology. And she's a real anchor of the group. She does everything. She programs Legionon. She runs that database. And also she's developed the tomography application. She also does a lot of collaborative projects and basically is in every corner of the resource. And Erica's our technician. She's the one managing the service and collaborative users and keeping them on track when they're in-house. We have a great group of grad students and postdocs. You've heard Pickway's work on the RLC, Anka on the ribosome, and Dimitri, who's working on a couple of different biological projects and a lot of technology development. And Arnie's going to be working on the membrane project. Neil's done a whole bunch of different collaborations and has really been quite key in putting Appian together. And then Gabe and Craig have left, but we haven't quite adjusted to that fact yet, so we're just leaving them in there tiny. We'll get used to it over time. Christopher's our systems admin. You know, we have terabytes and terabytes of data, obviously. And he's keeping that all calm and running and dealing with clusters and things like that. Everybody should know Lorraine by now, put this whole workshop together. This is the easiest Clint and I have ever had it in doing this workshop because Lorraine basically took care of everything, which was just wonderful. And then Ron, Clint, and I sort of manage and basically write grants, I think, and don't have any more fun so much, except for this workshop. But that's all I have to say. Thanks very much. Questions? Yeah?
So you said that you're releasing at the moment. Do you have any idea of the sort of time schedule?
Not really. I mean, it is released to some extent. You can go get it, and there's documentation telling you how to install it. But, you know, we don't really want to bog down in the support issues that will arise. I mean, several people have got it working. But there's all kinds of complications. You know, Appian itself is just a bunch of Python scripts. But what Appian manages is a dozen or so really big packages. Now, we can't release those. People have to go and get those separately and install them. So we'll have to work out how to advise people how to do that over the next several months. And we need to clean it up and make it easy before we could really say it's released. But anybody who wants to try it, you know, go for it. You can pull it off the website, appian.org, and there's documentation, and you can try it. But it's for the brave right now, not for everybody. So any other questions? Okay. Yeah?
See, you had the tomography on there. It seemed more that that was to set up models. But is Appian able to handle larger tomography data sets for actually doing a full cell or type of cell reconstruction?
I should ask Angie that. Is Angie? Yeah, what do you think, Angie?
I guess that would depend on what kind of collaborative project you start up. Without something to look at, I would not know what we need to do in order to make that happen to make it a more user or user. So I think that's the determining factor.
I mean, we basically just do things driven by the collaborators, you know, collaborators. So if somebody has a good project, that would drive it. We did a massive project with Janelia Farms to do large-scale montaging of serial sections. They have more images than us. I think they're well over a million because they just run this thing 24/7, stamping out images across sections. So, you know, there's all other things it can do, and you saw the robotic stuff from David Stokes. So we just add things as they're needed.